You're listening to the Broadway Podcast Network. Attention all theater lovers! This Sunday, April 21st, Broadway Podcast Network is holding the first ever Broadway Podfest, a full day of podcast recordings with some of your favorite Broadway stars, live from the Museum of Broadway, which is right in the heart of Times Square. The day begins at 11 a.m. Eastern and features a full day of programming that you don't want to miss. Visit bpn.fm/podfest to get all the details and register to attend for free. That's bpn.fm/podfest.
You are about to participate in the most ambitious culinary experiment ever imagined.
This competition is going to test everything.
Adapt quickly to anything. I mean anything. The wildest day of your life starts right now.
All new 24 and 24 Last Chef Standing. Sunday night at 8 on Food Network. Stream on Max.
I wanna be a producer with a hit show on Broadway.
You're listening to the Producer's Perspective Podcast with your host, Tony Award winner, Ken Davenport.
Hey everybody, it's Ken Davenport. We've got Rachel Chavkin, director Rachel Chavkin, on the podcast today, and she's going to talk about all sorts of things from Natasha Pierre and why she doesn't like to give advice, but we may have squeezed that a little bit anyway. But before we get to that podcast, I want to give a big shout out to this week's sponsor. Daniel Rader Photo is our podcast sponsor this week. He's an award-winning theater photographer whose work has been featured in newspapers, magazines, online publications, including The New York Times, never heard of it, Hollywood Reporter, Playbill, PBS, and lots more. He can do theater photography for your show, headshots if you are a performer or a producer or any kind of artist. Everyone needs a good shot on their website these days. Based here in New York City, but can travel, has passport, can travel. You can get in touch with Daniel at danielraderphoto.com. That's danielraderphoto.com. Check it out. He's done some great work for us, and I know he can do some great work for you. Now, let's get to Rachel.
Praised by Lin-Manuel Miranda as the future of musical theater, SUFS creator Shayna Taub makes Broadway history as only the second woman to write the book, music, lyrics, and star in her own original new musical. Don't miss the much-anticipated Broadway debut of the singular artist that Forbes calls visionary and Billboard anoints as one of the most inventive voices in musical theater. SUFS, the original new musical from Shayna Taub, is now playing on Broadway at the Music Box Theater. Get your tickets today at SUFSmusical.com. The Outsiders on Broadway tells the story of finding where you belong when the world refuses to accept you. Based on S.E. Hinton's beloved novel, featuring new music from Jamestown Revival and Justin Levine, and directed by Danya Taymor, Entertainment Weekly says that, with brilliant staging and some of the most captivating stage fighting currently on Broadway, The Outsiders has the power to inspire an entire generation. Get your tickets today at OutsidersMusical.com.
Hello, everybody, and welcome back to the Producer's Perspective Podcast. I am Ken Davenport. I'm very excited to have on the podcast today. We've been trying to schedule this sucker for months, but she's so in demand. She's been flying all over the world. One of the most talked about directors on the Broadway scene today, and one of the most sought after. Please welcome the Tony-nominated director, Rachel Chavkin. Welcome, Rachel.
Thanks, Ken.
So Rachel burst onto the scene with her incredibly unique production of Natasha Pierre and the Comet of 1812, which received the highest number of Tony nominations for any musical that season. She's directed at Lincoln Center, Williamstown, and many, many others. She's the director of the Broadway-bound Hadestown, which just got rave reviews in London, and while has not been announced yet, has been rumored to be coming in this spring. We'll see if we can get her to spill.
Oh, good.
So, Rachel, I started that introduction with, like, Rachel burst onto the scene.
I'm like, well, I was 32, so I've been doing things prior to that point.
I had a feeling you would disagree with this burst out to the scene.
Yeah.
So tell me how it got started for you, really.
I guess there's like so many different places you could like be a zygote, but I would say like work really got going after I graduated college. While I was in college, I'd begun making my own work and had been very, very drawn to experimental work, and in particular, the work of experimental ensembles. So like the Wooster Group Elevator Repair Service, Need Company, which is a Belgian company whose work I encountered through BAM, and the downtown scene. And so after leaving college, I was working for a few years as assistant director, and teaching and Barnes & Nobling and all the things. In 2004, I heard about the Edinburgh Fringe Festival, which I'd never been to before, but a playwright who I was working with wanted to bring a show that we were making to Edinburgh. And this show had like 15 people in it. And very quickly, like, I began learning about the festival and how it worked and was like, that is not going to happen for this show. But it made me want to make two shows that I had already been thinking about with some artist friends who I'd been collaborating with since college. And we got together and we ended up calling ourselves the team for the Fringe brochure because we like needed an ensemble name. And that was the founding of a company that I'm one of the founding members of, I'm the artistic director of, and is still operating today. And so the team kind of had its coming out at the 2005 Edinburgh Fringe Festival. We ended up winning the Fringe first in the first week of the festival out of like, you know, it's, I think it was like 3,000 something shows at that point. Not all of which are eligible for that award. It's a premier award, but we did very well at the festival, which then led to like an invitation to come back to the Traverse the following year, which then led to a little company called the National Theatre of Scotland that was just premiering, and John Tiffany, who was like this, you know, exploding director.
Yeah, I know.
He was like just beginning to explode at that time. It was the year they did Black Watch and we were doing a show and he saw it, which led to a first major commission. And so like it's why I work actually so much in the United Kingdom is because of all my ties through the Edinburgh Fringe Festival. And that was really the start of my working life. New York came much later and my freelance career came much later apart from my existence with the team.
So tell me about this. I was already starting to make my own work. Like, where did you get that impetus to do that? Why not just sit back and, oh, someone wants to do the Cherry Orchard or
sure.
Someone wants to do Anything Goes.
Sure. I know. It'd be so much easier. it wouldn't necessarily be so much easier. You can work really hard at that stuff, obviously. And I do now. I don't know. I guess a couple things. One, I saw my first Wooster Group show, House Lights, when I was 18. I think like a month into college. And I was like, what the? Can I swear on this?
I love when we get the explicit rating on iTunes. It's my favorite.
I was just like, what the fuck is this? And I couldn't get enough of it. And I didn't know what they were doing. And So already I became interested in artists who are not only creating original work and original content, but were doing it in pretty weird ways by like mainstream play standards. And then in my second year at school, I took a class called CAO, Creating Original Work. And it was taught by a really far out, brilliant experimental choreographer and dancer named Marlene Pennison. And the class happened on Sunday nights from 7 to 10 p.m. You did not get graded. You did not get marked down. Obviously, if you did or did not show up, there was like no attendance. You had like the rule was you were to bring snacks of some kind. And the only assignment was to be interesting alone on stage for 10 minutes. And it was a semester long course. And what I have, Marlene would say some of this, but most of this came in retrospect because she was actually pretty cryptic. But what became really clear is like, Marlene actually at the end of the day could not have cared less what you made. What she was interested in was putting you into the crisis of your own process. And so some people would not show the entire semester and then show up on the final showing day with like a fucking genius 10-minute piece. And other people would not show the entire semester and show up at the end and it would be like a shit show. And some people would bring in an entirely new 10-minute piece every single week and they would just like pick it up and put it off like clothing. And what I learned I had to do for myself was to slowly chip away at it, and specifically to give myself homework assignments, because I'd always been a good student. And so I began giving myself writing prompts and improvisation prompts or whatever to, in the face of which I could then generate material, because otherwise I was just in a vacuum. So that was how I began making my own work. And then the following year, and you could do cow as many times as you wanted. Like you just, you know, kept being with yourself,
as
basically.
Snacks.
As long as you have snacks. Oreos, big, popular. And then the next year I had to do an hour-long directing project as part of the curriculum. And there were, I was just also, I mean, you know, as like a 20-year-old, I was really ornery and really into counterculture. I mean, just like that. I grew up loving punk music. And I just was like, there's no plays that I want to do. There's no good hour-long plays, which is obviously bullshit. I know that now. But at that time, that was where I was coming from. And so me and my friend Jake Margolin decided to adapt Allen Ginsberg's poem Howl for the stage. And so that was the first time that I was working on another group of performers. And that was 4 men and 1 woman. And I literally like sat with scissors and tape and Xeroxed Howl and On the Road and Norman Mailer's essay, The White Negro, and then all of this writing about bebop jazz and what, in particular, these white poets were trying to emulate, appropriate, and fetishize and worship about what these black musicians were doing in music in the 50s. So that was the first piece I made. And like that's the DNA of the team.
So when you were taking cow,
yes,
were you classifying yourself as a director, writer, actor? Did you know what you wanted to do?
No, I didn't think too much. I mean, for Cow, you did everything because you were performing, you were writing, and you didn't have a director. Like, you had to do it by yourself. That was, I think, one of the rules. Actually, I'm not even sure that was a rule. But I did go, I went to NYU, and specifically within NYU, I went to the Playwrights Horizon Theater School for the majority of my time. I did the classical studio senior year. I definitely chose NYU and playwrights because I was interested in both acting and directing. So I definitely like did use those two words anyway, but in Cow it was very amorphous, which I loved.
So do you think this is one of those big what ifs?
Sure.
You've taken a very non-traditional approach, or this creating your own work in order to for your path to success on Broadway, mm-hmm. and for many years to come, I'm sure. Do you think it's happened quicker because you've created your own original work as opposed to going the assistant route and doing that for many years and going the more traditional route?
I wouldn't know. I mean, I don't think I was not the youngest person to ever make their Broadway debut, I think by a long shot. I don't actually know who that person was or how old they were. But I know that there were no stories about me being the youngest person ever. I was 32. I was by the time I made my Broadway debut, I was 30. Let's see, we opened in 2016. So I was 36. So that's well in the pocket of a mid-career artist.
Would you encourage younger artists, if they had a choice of creating original work that they could direct, who knows where it will be? Maybe it'll go to Broadway, maybe not.
Yeah.
Or going after the more traditional route and directing Shakespeare and
I don't know if that's
musicals.
Any more traditional. I mean, I guess I would say two things. One is I try not to ever give advice explicitly because I think it's very presumptuous that there's something about my experience that is relevant to your experience. That said, when I taught, I would say the task is to direct. And so if you're not directing for prolonged stretches, it might be hard to call yourself a director. Now, there's a lot of different aspects of work that make up a director's life. So when I say if you're not directing, that doesn't necessarily mean rehearsing in a room. That could be prepping or sitting with scissors and scotch tape and like piecing together the script that one day you're visualizing and you're going to do research for, and go to the picture collection at the public library and, you know, pull images for all of that is the work of directing. But fundamentally, that's the only distinction between if you're a director or not. So I certainly would say always be making your own work. But you can do that alongside assisting in formal, you know, paid capacities as well, because you have to eat.
Tell me about the origins of Natasha Pierre. How did that start for you?
Yeah, so Comet was Dave's and my third show together, I think. So I met Dave through the downtown experimental scene. Dave is a part of a company called Banana Bag and Bodice with amazing artists Jason Craig and Jessica Jelliff. And I had seen this show that they made together called Beowulf, A Thousand Years of Baggage, which I loved. And I saw it like 50 times. And I actually don't think I'm exaggerating because I've toured with it. They were in Edinburgh when we were in Edinburgh. So I've seen it many, many, many times. I really love the show. And in 2009, I was working with a playwright, actually the same one who years before had brought up the Edinburgh Fringe Festival. And she was now at Vassar College, which definitely goes to like that lesson of you just have no idea where people are going to end up being. So she was on visiting faculty Vassar College, and as part of that, they were going to do a play of hers. And that was, I think, one of my first paid gigs outside of the team. It was one of my first freelance gigs. And she wanted to make this play into a musical. And did I know any composers? And so I called Dave, basically cold calling, was like, do you want to come up to Vassar and do a show with me? And we ended up living together in Poughkeepsie and just getting to know each other over a month working with the students. And it was wonderful because it was very low. I mean, obviously we took seriously our responsibility to the students, but it was like totally low stakes in terms of what artistically needed to emerge.
Do you remember why he said yes?
He had just moved to the city and he had no money. So it was a job, you know, it was a job. And we had liked each other. I mean, like we had enjoyed each other's presence at parties. But he had just moved and he didn't have any work for the fall. So, you know, so then we were like strolling across the green one day and like talking about dream projects. And he said, there's this sliver of, have you read War and Peace? There's this sliver. And we got to talking about it. And then we did another show, Three Pianos, together. And so by the time Ars Nova commissioned Dave as their artist in residence, composer in residence, we had this deep collaboration. And that was how.
Did you ever imagine that it would end up on a Broadway stage? Did you think, oh, this could go all the way someday?
No, because I don't think of Broadway as all the way. I love Broadway. I grew up getting taken to Broadway, but I think because of my work in the experimental sphere, because through that getting to do a bunch of international travel, and so like seeing shows at the National and seeing shows at the Hong Kong Arts Festival and in Holland at this incredible arts festival that I was there for in 2000, like those are all destinations. So Broadway is a specific destination, and certainly it's a destination where you can really make a living, which is remarkable. Both, you know, for myself as a individual artist, but also it's so amazing to work in an environment where I'm not worried about whether my company, either the on stage or off stage, has health insurance, can afford a babysitter. Those are major quality of life things that, you know, are so often neglected. And so it's wonderful to be in an environment that I'm not worried about that.
What was the biggest surprise you had when you got to, having had this experience?
Yeah.
Having had this experience all over the world,
yeah,
these amazing experiences.
Yeah.
Then you're like, oh my gosh, your show's going to come to Broadway. Isn't this great and exciting?
Yes.
What was the biggest surprise to you when you got there? Like, whoa.
Oh.
This is different than these other incredible places.
Oh, that's funny. The first thing I was going to say is the major surprise was actually that, oh, tech is tech. Which actually was, I was surprised that it was the same. You know, it was bigger. There were, I couldn't reorient. I drove my both stage manager and our incredible wardrobe team like incredibly crazy because A, we didn't have enough tech time, but B, my brain is always trying to move for maximum efficiency. And so if it makes sense for us to like tech a scene for a given moment, I just like got schooled in terms of how quickly a costume change can happen for like the whole building. Also, we had 30 people on stage. So that was a surprise, or a learning experience. But ultimately, like that tech is tech was actually surprising and encouraging. And then I don't know, there are many things about Paloma Garcia Lee, one of our incredible ensemble members and our dance captain. She dubbed Comet. We had this long running joke where me and Sam Pinkleton, our choreographer, would turn to Paloma and say, well, what would they do on regular Broadway? and that was a term that she'd come up with. She would say, well, on regular Broadway, they would do this. And then one day, I think I asked, what are we? And she very kindly said, this is extraordinary Broadway.
What did she mean?
Well, from a choreographic perspective, Comet had 20 entirely unique ensemble tracks, which our swings had to cover. And the ensemble tracks were built very, very deliberately to celebrate the body shape and the body moves that felt good for each individual performer, because one of the missions of that show was to create a space that is as divergent and multi-hyphenate as the world that Tolstoy was writing about. I mean, it was both dramaturgically related and very political for Dave and Sam and I and the whole company. Was the celebration of race and class and queerness and all of those different people coming together. I mean, it was part of the audience design as well. It was Mimi's big raison d'etre was that everyone be in the same room together and be able to see each other. So the audience on stage, the entire room enveloped with this red velvet curtain, that kind of community coming together with shakers and dumplings to like receive this story and feed into this story. That was very hand built. And as a result, it was, extraordinary Broadway, I think, meant like it was very anti factory line, right? Like it's in fact rejecting the point of why numbers go across a Broadway stage why you have a chorus line, and that made it sort of a, you know, I said to the audience, not to the audience, I said to the cast, and on the closing show in our like pre-show pep talk, you know, there was nothing, Comet was not ever built to be sustainable. And it got very large in ways that were not necessarily my intention, but fundamentally, I think the spirit of the show was that it felt like the band playing as the Titanic sinks. And that is a level of like exertion and exhaustion. I think all those things made it.
What do you think of the phrase immersive theater?
What do I think of it?
Yeah, do you,
it's
if someone,
several syllables.
That's true. Okay, next question.
Yeah.
Do you like it when people say, oh, Natasha Pierre was like immersive theater?
Yeah, I mean, it's fine. It seems to help people know a bit what to expect.
Do you think of it that way?
I don't think of it as participatory theater in any way. I don't think of it as, I mean, I guess what I would be concerned about with that label for the production is I never wanted people to be afraid. We talked a lot about good touch, bad touch, with the cast is like what, and I think And that's both a literal thing of like touching and also a spiritual thing of the mode in which eye contact is delivered. And I think it has everything to do with not being desperate. If you are secure in yourself, you can sort of meet anyone's eyes generously. And if they are secure in themselves, they will look back at you. And if not, you lose nothing if they look away. And so you don't have to grab them by the chin and be like, look at me. You know, so it's like being confident in your own fiction or your own reality is maybe a better way of saying that. That said, I don't know. I guess I don't think of, I never thought of the integrity of performance of the acting in Comet any differently than I do with Hadestown, for example. And Hadestown is now a proscenium. I mean, it's in the Olivier, so it's a bit of a thrust, but for all intents and purposes, it's an end-on show. And I hope it feels as immersive, like feels as overwhelming. You know, as I said, I can remember going to, you know, clubs in DC for music, and I would be, though I don't get to go to music nearly as much anymore, but like, I want to feel it in my bones. And I think I seek the same experience in theater.
And do you think our generation, we're close enough and we're about a decade apart, but do you think that's what our generation's theater going will be in 10 years, like everyone wanting to be inside it? Will it be different than our parents' theater and our grandparents' theater?
Probably. I think that's true. You know, I don't know. It's hard because, like, if you read the writings of, like, any young artist or any intense artists, like you read a manifesto, and that's a self-selecting group, because the people who are driven to write a manifesto are seeking something. They're like seeking to mainline something. And that's, I could go back to a manifesto from the late 19th century, and we would feel like someone who's like bashing their head into a wall. But like, you know, thinking about ooh-wah or, but that said, I mean, the move towards VR, the move towards the personal entertainment system, making a gesture of an iPhone that I'm holding in front of my face, that is a very, like, you are mainlining that directly into your central nervous system. So it certainly makes sense to me that people will seek that same vividness on stages.
So Natasha Pierre, Hadestown, we were just talking about you involved with Lipica.
Yes.
Obviously you're attracted to shows with very interesting titles.
But
sure. What else about a show makes you say, oh, this, I wanna do this one?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. About half of or three quarters of what I'm doing is just like from people who now I know. So first and foremost, what makes me want to do something is someone I love is a part of it. Like Bess Wohl, pretty much. I just actually scheduled, didn't work out for a show with her, playwright. But like anytime she called me, I would be there.
We're a big fan of Bess here. Yeah. She did a podcast for us. She's terrific.
So good. And obviously so many other folks are the same. So that's number one. Number two is if there's historical elements, I love history. If there's political elements, if the piece is a good vehicle for politics, which is not necessarily, doesn't necessarily mean that there's overt politics as part of it, but, and politics for me infiltrates everything. So it's the, diversity, and I mean that specifically racial diversity, though also cultural diversity, age diversity of the creative team, of the cast. Sometimes it'll be the poetry of the language. And if I can feel the language like needing to be articulated in space.
Plays or musicals, what do you prefer?
Don't have a preference. Plays are harder.
Why?
I find. Plays don't specify time. And so, like, working on Carol Churchill's Light Shining in Buckinghamshire was one of my favorite experiences of my artistic existence. And Carol's, I mean, the text is actually quite compressed on the page, but me and the actors would be working through it, and it's like, I think something happened between that sentence and that sentence, but there's no stage direction, there's not even a paragraph break necessarily. So you have to figure out actually whether there's, okay, if we take like 30 seconds of stillness while you drool a bit, performer X, and then, you know, regain your senses and then go on to the next line, does that make this moment, does that make the next line have as much integrity as possible? And that's ultimately all we can use. And by that, you could mean emotional truth or however you want to put it. But like, do you mean the words that you are saying? So plays don't specify that navigation necessarily in a way that musicals do, because there's a, you know, even if it's not set to click, there's basically a, you know, the rhythm that the composer has specified. So musicals are more logistically challenging. It's like driving, obviously, you know, a fleet of cars versus like a single sedan that you're all packed into the back of. But
you mentioned diversity. There's been a lot of talk about the lack of gender diversity, certainly in the captain of the ship role, mm-hmm. of being a director on a Broadway production. Have you felt that struggle? Did you feel that struggle when you were on your way? Do you feel it now?
Yeah. So what would I say? So yes, there's a huge lack of parity. I think the way it mostly plays out, from at least my experience, is I just don't know what plays I'm not getting offered. And I mean plays, musicals. I just don't know what jobs I'm not getting, because you just don't get necessarily called into that room. And I, the thing that I would say I clock again and again is young genius boy. And I think he, in my experience, for the most part, is always special. I mean, I taught, you know, for 13 years at NYU, and I can name so many young genius men who do something and you just like push them and elevate them, and they rise very, very rapidly in a way that would take a, seems to take a woman of equivalent age at that time. You have to do like 5 shows very well before you get that Broadway production. So I think that's a major difference, is the rate at which you move from directing an indie to directing a blockbuster in Hollywood language. I think the other big way it differentiates, and and this is something I process all the time still, and I became particularly aware of it when Dave Malloy and I started having a bunch of meetings together after Comet. And it was amazing to watch Dave have a meeting. So I was like, oh my God, he's so clear about what he wants. He knows the pitch and et cetera. And I don't. And I don't, I, you know, and so that sent me into a long and, again, ongoing process of going, well, is that because women aren't taught to say what we want at very young ages, that it would seem impolite? Is that because women's thinking is less linear, and more mysterious? I mean, we can begin to spiral off into all sorts of, gender stereotypes / maybe real neurology, and the space between those things is actually, it's so blurry right now. And it's also so binary in ways that I'm not particularly interested in thinking. But yeah, I think about that a lot. It's just like training your brain to have a meeting, which I felt like I didn't ever quite learn, and maybe nailed.
Yeah, I was going to say, are you better at it today, do you think?
I'm probably a bit better. But also, sometimes now, I feel uninterested in being better at it. Like, I want to be on my terms, right? So this is the other flip side of it is, women maybe are getting to enough of a place where it's like, well, what if I don't want to wear my power like a man? What if I want to wear my power like a fucking woman? And so does that mean that we're going to have more circular conversations? And does our process have to be set up for exactly this? And also, what's a climax of a play? And what if I'm much more interested in Gertrude Stein than Aristotle? So, you know, then we can begin to really...
Well, that's a deep one right there.
Well, it's all...
I mean, Aristotle was a man.
Like, of course he was. I don't. You might, I don't.
But that's part of the challenge, right?
Mm-hmm. Right, is what we value, is very determined based on the dominant culture and power structures. And that, of course, goes to white supremacy as well. And what is beautiful and what is funny. And what is a good joke and what is high art? And all of that are really deep questions.
We'll just let that one sit there for a second so our listeners may ponder it. What's your rehearsal room like?
It's funny.
It's funny, really?
Yeah, yeah.
Oh, with all this, you're obviously a very smart woman, very intellectual. You think about things. I can see your brain turning, and you have it's a circus in there?
I guess I would say a few things. Other people would obviously be able to answer better, because you sort of, as a director, particularly I assisted very rarely, so I don't know much how other people's rooms are. I know we laugh a lot. I know that I'm a very rigorous, like I'll just keep going over and over and over something and changing and changing. Like I'll keep refining until they basically pry the play from my golden hands. So there's that. And then I try to assume that everyone is as smart as I am, but it's going to be bringing a different kind of expertise to the work. And if I have cast the show well and assembled the creative team well, then everyone is really empowered to bring what their expertise is. And it's going to be different than my expertise. So, which is all to say it's a pretty collaborative room, but I find that to be like a meaningless thing to say. Because everyone would say so. Oh, not everyone. Some people would probably say they run a dictatorship, which is cool too. I don't know. Oh, and I guess the last thing I would say is, in terms of the circus comment, is I do really believe that actors take a long time to organize all the different things that they are coordinating, including where they're breathing, what lines they're saying, what note they're supposed to be singing, much less how they are interested in inflecting that note on a vocal technique level, much less what they mean to the other person or want from the other person they are making eye contact with, much less whether they want to cross and step first on their right foot versus their left foot. So like all of those, and I haven't even gone through half of it, much less like what costume they're wearing and whether their pants are too tight and is the light in their eyes. So like all of these things are so much information that I think an actor is synthesizing. And thus I feel very comfortable living for a while in mess and chaos while the actor brings some of that information into focus. And often I'll like nudge in different directions to try to steer a ship in a way that I'm interested in going. I will absolutely be like, you know, abort mission if it's moving in a way that I'm not interested in. But I am very okay with living with chaos for long periods of time, because I know the second we hit tech, I'm gonna say you have to stand 16 inches to the left because that's where I want to put the light, you know, so I'll get my say at a certain point.
Knowing that actors do take a long time to negotiate all those different mm-hmm. things, What do you look for in an audition? What makes you go, oh yeah, this person can do it, even though it may be messy right now?
Whether they have the spirit of the character. I mean, I don't see bad actors anymore, you know, like I haven't for years and years at the level that I'm auditioning, is I'm seeing professionals who have been, even if they're young, even if they're quite early career, something has happened to like get them into that room via the casting director. So then the only thing I care about is whether they are in step with what that character requires. And that's going to be different. So there's not like a universal answer to that question because it'll depend entirely on the vibe of the show and the tone of the role and how we're approaching it.
Okay, my last question, which is my genie question.
Genie question.
Yes. Okay. I want you to imagine the genie from Aladdin comes to visit you.
I like that movie.
And also a musical.
Yes, I've seen it. Dave and I went and did a double header of that in Lion King.
Oh, I want to hear what you think after. So, and the genie grants you one wish. What's the thing that drives you crazy about Broadway or the theater in general that actually would make you bang your head against the wall, that would get you so upset that you'd ask this genie to wish away in an instant?
Oh. I am going to flip it to a positive, which is because I was just at the National for 2 months doing Hadestown there. And it was one of the happiest working experiences, maybe the happiest working experience of my life on so many different fronts, like coming together to mean that. And there are two things that the National had that I thought were awesome, which I would genie wish on like the Broadway community and then every nonprofit institution in the country. And they're both on the second floor. There was a canteen that was open all day, where every staff member, a crew member, and artist working in that building could get a hot and nutritious meal for £4 or a wrap, or like cold prepared food for like £2. That was extraordinary. And right next door to the canteen was a staff bar, where you could bring guests after the show or pre-show, but it was for the staff, and beers and wine and booze was cheap. And I found those two things quite remarkable and made for a quality of life. I remember a friend was talking about London, and I was like, do you want to ever run a theater there? And he's like, no, you don't make enough money. And we were talking about it, and he's very affectionate to it, but he was like, well, no one gets rich there, but also no one, you know, is at sea there in a way that I just think you can be really at sea here because our government is so cruel, and this country is so cruel in terms of social justice and social safety net programs. So that canteen and that bar were both awesome. They're good food and fun drinks, but also they were symbols of a community that wants to hang out with you, a building that was built by a government that cares about art. I would genie wish those.
What a great idea. And it's so funny because this country is not very good at that sort of thing, except every major corporation will have a commissary or a cafeteria for the same exact reasons that the National does.
Yeah.
Fantastic idea. Thank you so much for that idea. Thank you for joining us here today. Good luck with everything.
I want to say also, though, and maybe people can like DM me on Twitter or something, but Nate Koch, producer Nate Koch, and I really want to create a daycare co-op also for both the Broadway community and downtown communities. So that's a genie wish. That's like a slipped in genie wish.
As the dad of an 8-month-old, I'm showing her a photo right now. I'm into that.
Yeah.
So maybe we can chat about it.
Yeah.
All right. Thanks so much. Thanks to all of you for listening. We will see you next time.
Be a producer. Look out, Broadway. Here I am.
They say well-behaved women seldom make history. Just ask the Supps. A vibrant and wholly original new musical, Supps celebrates the real women who changed history and their story that is more timely than ever. See the show Variety calls an epic tour de force new musical. Deadline Cheers is a rare Broadway feat and leaves audiences inspired to keep marching. Supps has arrived on Broadway and not a moment too soon. Get your tickets today at suppsmusical.com. If you love Broadway gossip, you are not going to want to miss any episode of this podcast, Singular Sensation, The Triumph of Broadway. Plenty of dramas unfold on stage, but the best dramas unfold backstage. And there were no bigger dramas than behind the scenes of Sunset Boulevard.
So you were being crucified over here, but not there.
No. No, because I was turning in a performance that would get standing ovations. Excuse me.
So check out my podcast, Singular Sensation, for all the juicy and gory details of Sunset Boulevard.